Okay, listen up, everybody. All right, so if you got to discuss something really important, step outside, okay? So don't make too much noise, because we got to zip through lecture right here. And some people, I've heard that some people actually like to listen to these lectures, help prepare for the test, so listen up. All right, so we got stroke volume. Stroke volume is a variable that we use to calculate what parameter? Blood volume. Well, what is stroke volume? That's the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time a ventricle beats, right? So it's a volume per beat, right? And we use it to calculate cardiac output. And I think maybe I had that on the board last time. Okay, so we got some important variables right here. Let me get my mouses in order. All right, so stroke volume is determined by these three variables right here. And we're going to talk about these three variables in maybe three or four different contexts, and after a little bit, you'll become a little bit familiar with them, but we got to start someplace. So end-diastolic volume, right? What volume is that of a ventricle? Is that the big volume or small volume? Okay, that's the big volume, right? It's at the end of diastole, and diastole is filling. And as the ventricles fill, they expand. So end-diastolic volume is the large volume of blood, right, at the end of diastole, and then it contracts, and then after contraction, you have the end systolic volume. That's a small volume. All right, total peripheral resistance. This is the impedance to blood flow in arteries, so that when the heart contracts, it's got to counteract this resistance in order to pump blood into an artery. And then myocardial contractility is the strength of ventricular contraction. And then sometimes, well, you know what, that these all relate to the stroke volume of the heart, okay, myocardial contractility. All right, so end-diastolic volume is what we call the preload on the heart prior to contraction. And stroke volume is directly proportional to preload and contractility. So what does that mean? If end-diastolic volume goes up, even though we call it the preload, if end-diastolic volume goes up, what happens to stroke volume and contractility? If it's directly related, that's right. So if end-diastolic volume goes up, the heart gets stronger. If end-diastolic volume goes down, the heart gets weaker. And nobody wants to have a weaker heart, or weaker and weaker heart, or weaker, 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 and even getting more weak heart, because then it won't pump any blood at all. All right, so the strength of contraction of the ventricles varies directly with end-diastolic volume, up to a point. All right, I'll put the whole graph on the board in just a little bit. Total peripheral resistance, sometimes we call this the afterload, right? That impedes the ejection of blood from a ventricle into arteries. So, right, as total peripheral resistance goes up, stroke volume goes down. The ejection fraction, this is an important parameter, and it is the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart, which is the stroke volume, compared to what the whole end-diastolic volume is. All right, so if the heart pumps out 50 mLs of blood, but the end-diastolic volume is 100 mLs, then what is this ejection fraction? Then it's going to be half, right? It's going to be 50%. So this is a measure of how well the heart is doing. Normally, it's about 60%. This is an extremely useful tool because as the heart function deteriorates, ejection fraction decreases. All right, so 40 to 55% means that the heart is damaged and that there probably should be some kind of clinical intervention. And so this parameter is used for timing of surgery. You don't want to get close to 40% because that means irreversible damage to the heart and heart failure. All right, so if you get to 40%, and clinically we don't really like to talk about this because we hate to talk about irreversible situations, right? We always try to do the most for our patients as possible. But after a certain point, there's relatively little you can do to save that heart. So you want to stay away from 40%. If it gets 40% or less, all right, then guess what you need? There's nothing that you can do to save that heart. Guess what you need then if you're a patient? Yeah, you need a new heart. Who wants a new heart? Nobody wants to go through that. All right, so this is an important parameter to be looking at all the time. All right, so we're going to look at the intrinsic control of the heart. So this, in terms of contractility, so this doesn't involve any kinds of reflexes, doesn't involve any kind of nervous system. It's just a property of the heart itself. All right, so The Frank Starling law of the heart, you should just commit this to memory, states that the strength of ventricular contraction varies directly with end diastolic volume. All right, so that means, let's look at this plot right here. So here is stroke volume plotted against end diastolic volume. And as end diastolic volume increases, what happens to stroke volume or contractility of the heart? Does it increase, stay the same, or decrease? You can see that it increases. That's why we call it directly related. Right? So stroke volume is directly related to end diastolic volume. And as a matter of fact, I see three different curves right here. There's something else that is excitatory on the myocardium that can increase force of contraction. It's the autonomic nervous system. And in particular, what division of the autonomic nervous system? The sympathetic nervous system, right? So if sympathetic nervous system tone or activity increases, even at a particular end diastolic volume, just at one end diastolic volume right here, the force of contraction will increase, right, as sympathetic tone increases. So the force of contraction, right, is controlled by sympathetic tone. And we would call that what? A positive inotropic effect on the heart. Now, the parasympathetic nervous system, from what we talked about last time, cannot regulate force of contraction, only the sympathetic nervous system. But what does the parasympathetic nervous system do in terms of the heart? What can it regulate? What can it regulate? It can't regulate the force of contraction, but it can regulate the rate of contraction, right? And that's not inotropy. What did we call that? Chronotropy, right? So parasympathetic stimulation is a negative chronotropic agent on the heart. So that's some ways to think about it. All right, so this might be a little surprising to you, but what do you know? You know a lot about myofilaments already. You know a lot about myosin and actin, right, and sliding filament mechanism. All right, so that's what we're going to use to explain the Frank Starling law of the heart. All right, so here we have the same sarcomere, okay, at different levels of stretch. So this happens, and we're looking at before contraction actually takes place. All right, so in order for this sarcomere to shorten, as what's happening during contraction, right, there has to be an optimal overlap, or there has to be any kind of overlap between actin and myosin in order for cross bridges to form. All right, so here we have three different graphs, A, B, C, and D, and one of these will be able to produce the maximum amount of tension because of the proper overlap between actin and myosin. So let's look at condition A right here. All right, so the sarcomere is very short, which corresponds to what kind of end diastolic volume? The heart is really filled up with blood or very little blood in the ventricles? Very little, because the heart's not stretched out, right? So end diastolic volume is relatively low, right? And we see that there's plenty of overlap between actin and myosin right here. But if we look at the sarcomere, we see that it can't shorten at all anymore because myosin is now from Z-disc to Z-disc, right? So contraction cannot take place. As you stretch the heart out a little bit, as we see in condition B right over here, all right, so now end diastolic volume is increasing a little bit. So this means that this sarcomere can shorten, but still it can only shorten to a little degree. So if we look at the curve, tension produced versus time, consider this like a twitch of myocardial tissue. Condition A, where there is complete overlap, but the myosin fills up the sarcomere, when that contracts, it produces very little tension. As the muscle is stretched out, we still have very nice overlap between actin and myosin, right? That can produce a little bit of tension. But as the ventricle gets stretched out more and more and more, like in condition D over here, notice that it can produce a great amount of tension because the sarcomere can actually shorten when you have cross-bridge cycling between this myosin and actin right here. All right, so we see, with the diagram on the right over here, we see different levels of end diastolic volume, meaning that the ventricle is really small, getting bigger, getting bigger, getting bigger, still in condition D, and that produces the most amount of tension because the sarcomere can shorten the most under these circumstances. All right, so just by looking at overlap of actin and myosin, we can see that end diastolic volume is directly related to the tension that's produced inside the heart. So not only does the heart have to fill with blood, right, in order for it to pump blood when it contracts, but as the heart fills up with blood, it gets stronger because of the Frank Starling law of the heart. So that's really nice. All right, so a nice, really nice picture of the Frank Starling law. Let's see what my next slide looks like. Oh, okay, that's okay. I want to probably go back. Don't know how to go back. So let me just draw this, ignore that slide for the moment. So let's really draw what the Frank Starling law of the heart really says. All right, so we're going to make a plot with these two variables right here. We're going to say N diastolic volume, and then over here we're going to plot contractility or strength of contraction of the heart. All right, so contractility right here. All right, so if there's no blood in the ventricles, they don't get stretched out, right? So there's not an optimal overlap of actin and myosin. Myosin fills up the whole sarcomere because the filaments haven't separated as at all. So contractility is very, very low. And as the end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to force of contraction? You actually could have seen it on the previous slide. How about, can I go back? Oh, look, I got this mouse working. Previous. Okay. What happens to force of contraction? It increases. Increases, increases, increases. Right? And this is kind of where this graph stops. But now if you start to stretch the heart out even more, what's going to happen? What in terms of actin and myosin? So let's just say my top hand is myosin and my lower hand is actin. And as we stretch the heart out more, what happens? The heart starts to get weaker once again because you don't have overlap of actin and myosin. And if the heart is stretched out even more, then there's no contraction taking place at all. Because why? Because actin doesn't overlap with myosin. There can't be an interaction. So here is what the Frank Starling law really looks like. We have an ascending limb and a descending limb of the strength of the Frank Starling curve. All right, so let's just say somebody has a really weak heart because they got into an accident and they started to hemorrhage and they're losing a lot of blood. So if a lot of blood is running out on the ground, how much is going back to the heart? Not as much as when the person was normal. So what happens to end-diastolic volume when you're low on blood volume because of hemorrhage? The end-diastolic volume goes down. What happens to the heart when that happens? Just when you need to have a strong heart, what happens to it? It gets weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. All right, so under this circumstance, in this ascending limb, okay, this is what happens, for instance, like during blood loss, severe blood loss. Right, the heart gets weaker and weaker, unfortunately. So what's a really easy way to counteract this situation? Okay, we can put blood back into their cardiovascular system or even just fluids, right, even just saline solution. Right, so paramedics can hook people up to saline solution on the way to the hospital. Primary reason is because if somebody is hypovolemic, losing blood volume, right, by just hooking up saline, the end-diastolic volume goes up, and what happens to that person's heart? It gets stronger, so you pull them out of heart failure, cardiovascular collapse as a result of that. Okay. All right, let's look at this descending limb right here. Descending limb means that the end-diastolic volume is too great. Okay, and this can happen when somebody has hypertension and the heart gets weak day after day, or maybe even diabetes and even chronic alcohol use. The heart gets weaker, so it starts to fill up with blood, and now the heart is stretched out as a result because of volume overload. Actin and myosin get too far apart so that they can't interact. All right, so this is a volume overload condition. All right, so as end-diastolic volume gets bigger and bigger and bigger, what happens to contractility of the heart? It's overstretched. It gets weaker and weaker and weaker. How could you treat a patient that has too much blood volume? Okay, take some volume out of their cardiovascular system. And I wouldn't suggest maybe using a needle to suck it out, but how could you reduce the volume of somebody's cardiovascular system? By, for instance, giving them a diuretic. Okay, and so they lose volume from their cardiovascular system. They literally pee that volume out of their body. And what happens? The heart gets stronger and stronger and stronger. It's like a miracle drug for somebody in heart failure if they're in that kind of heart failure. Okay, if they're in a volume overload circumstance. All right, so that's really the Frank Starling law. Is it extrinsic or intrinsic? It's intrinsic because it just pertains to the proteins that are inside the heart. It happens irrespective of the autonomic nervous system or other factors inside the body. All right, so that's intrinsic. We still have to think about extrinsic control of the heart. And how is the heart controlled extrinsically? At least in terms of contractility. The sympathetic nervous system. What about parasympathetic nervous system in terms of contractility? It has no effect, right? So parasympathetic nervous system is only a chronotropic agent, but not an inotropic agent. All right, so only inotropy is controlled only by the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so at any given end diastolic volume, contraction depends on sympathoadrenal activity, which is just sympathetic tone inside the body as a result of norepinephrine and epinephrine being released on the heart. All right, so for sure that's going to increase heart rate, but it's also going to increase force of contraction due to an increase in calcium within the sarcomeres. That's the effect of norepinephrine and epinephrine on the ventricular myocardium. So if we look at a plot of tension versus muscle length right here, and we just pick one end diastolic volume, okay, so here we see skeletal muscle. Okay, as we stretch a skeletal muscle out, what happens to its force of contraction? It also increases because cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle have sarcomeres, right, until you reach that optimal overlap between actin and myosin. These last two curves right here are cardiac muscle, with and without epinephrine or norepinephrine. Okay, so without epinephrine, which is a sympathetic effector on heart muscle, all right, notice that this curve is shifted to the right. You have to be at higher end diastolic volumes, all right, in order to produce the same contraction. All right, so let's just use this line right here. So let's just say at an end diastolic volume of 90% of whatever it is at a optimal volume, okay, with sympathetic, okay, activity, which we see right here, all right, then, okay, oh, let's just stay right here, all right, we have to go up to this curve, right, so at the same end diastolic volume, what is the tension that's being produced? Is it greater or less with sympathetic activity? Okay, it's greater because here it is, it's about maybe 70, okay, relative percent without sympathetic activity, but with sympathetic activity, it's what? Close to 90 relative percent right here. So the force of contraction is greater with sympathetic activity going to the heart. And we call that extrinsic control because these nerves are coming from outside of the heart. Okay, so that's what that slide shows. All right, so here is a good quiz for you guys. Make sure you can jot this down, but let's analyze this little quiz right here so that it makes some sense. So cardiac output, and probably on your PowerPoint slide, you should write down, what are the units of cardiac output? It's a flow, it's blood flow, which is a volume per time, like milliliters per minute would be great. So put milliliters per minute. Cardiac output is equal to these two parameters right here. The heart rate, or you could say cardiac rate, and what are the units of heart rate? Beats per minute, right? We put this on the board last time, times stroke volume. And what's stroke volume? It is volume per time, right? So not per time, but per beat is what I actually like right here. So volume per beat, and you see that the beats cancel out, and you're left with the proper units for cardiac output, which is milliliters per minute. Okay, on this slide, something else that's pretty cool right here. Oh, I didn't actually show you the one that I used for the key, which would have been nice. But anyway, we see intrinsic control and extrinsic control. Let's look at extrinsic control first. What are the structures for extrinsic control of the heart? Okay, so the autonomic nervous system. Exactly right, autonomic nervous system. And you got two divisions of the autonomic nervous system, parasympathetic and sympathetic. One of these is excitatory on the heart, the other is inhibitory, and the dashed line represents which one of those? It's inhibitory, right? And the parasympathetic nerves go to the sinoatrial node, but notice that parasympathetic nerves do not go to the ventricular muscle. Right, so parasympathetic nerves can only affect the chronotropy of the heart, but not the inotropy of the heart. Right, and indeed, parasympathetic nerves, right, decrease heart rate. Sympathetic nerves, on the other hand, right, they're antagonistic to the parasympathetic nervous system, so they increase heart rate. Right, but sympathetic nerves also go to the ventricular myocardium, so they can affect also the force of contraction. Right. And what does it do? It increases force of contraction by increasing calcium inside the heart muscle cells. All right, so that's extrinsic control of the heart. And then what do we have over here? Frank Starling Law. What is this? This is the intrinsic control of the heart. And it controls not the heart rate, but the contractility or the force of contraction. Frank Starling Law, right, controls inotropy of the heart or force of contraction. So as the heart stretches out more, force of contraction increases because of the Frank Starling Law, just because of an overlap of actin and myosin. So stroke volume increases. And right, and that is controlled by the end diastolic volume. Right, so as end diastolic volume goes up, we see that the force of contraction goes up to a point. Right, if you're on that descending limb, then of course the heart is just too stretched out. But in some cases, that can be really easily treated. How would you treat this condition right here if the heart is too stretched out? With a diuretic, yeah. And somebody's heart strength can come back, right, just in a matter of minutes, half hour, maybe an hour, or something like that. Okay, now mean arterial, end diastolic volume. What do we call end diastolic volume? Right, that increases stroke volume. We call that the preload on the heart, right? So preload is directly related to stroke volume in a positive sense. Mean arterial pressure, on the other hand, is controlled by resistance in blood vessels. And as resistance increases, what happens to stroke volume? It goes down. All right, so we see that that's another dashed line over here. Okay, so this is a pretty good figure for you to figure out extrinsic, intrinsic, positive chronotropic agent, positive inotropic agent. Okay, related to these terms right here. All right, so let's look at venous return. All right, venous return is the return of blood to the heart via veins. It controls end diastolic volume because if no blood is returning via the veins, then the heart can't fill up with blood. All right, so it controls end diastolic volume, and if it controls end diastolic volume, it controls stroke volume. Why does it, and what, if stroke volume goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up because it's just directly related, right? So that you should have kind of an intuitive sense, right? If you can draw this diagram out, then you should have an intuitive sense for that. All right, so end diastolic volume is dependent on blood volume, okay? You can decrease blood volume by hemorrhage, for instance. You can increase blood volume by giving a transfusion, if that's a problem, all right? And it's also dependent on vasoconstriction caused by increasing sympathetic tone on veins in particular. Okay, and so when veins vasoconstrict, that's going to force blood to the heart. So if you pressurize a vein, if you squeeze down on a vein, how come blood doesn't squish back down to an extremity like a fingertip or a foot or something? What do veins have? In that sense, they're similar to the heart. They have valves in them, right? So when veins vasoconstrict, blood doesn't get squished back down to the periphery someplace. It gets pushed back to the heart to join the circulation. And that increases end diastolic volume. Also, whenever you use a skeletal muscle, right, and push blood and veins around, which way are you going to push it? Back to the heart, once again, because of the valves. And also the respiratory pump. Don't forget about the respiratory pump. Even every time you increase the volume of your thoracic cavity, that sucks blood back up toward the heart from the periphery. Okay, so we call that the respiratory pump. Yeah, respiratory pump. Okay, so skeletal muscle pump, respiratory pump return blood to the heart, increasing end diastolic volume. All right, so blood volume is controlled by your kidneys in one way, right, by adjusting urine volume. All right, so if the kidneys produce very little urine, then blood volume will increase or be maintained. That's going to increase venous return. That increases end diastolic volume. That increases cardiac output on the heart. Breathing, okay, just by breathing increases venous return because you decrease the pressure. We call that intrathoracic pressure. And so not only is air sucked into your thoracic cavity, but any other fluids in your body are as well, like venous blood. Okay, and then pressure in veins due to skeletal muscle pumps and venoconstriction that's produced by sympathetic tone, right? When that constricts a vein, that's going to increase venous return because of valves. Right, and the skeletal muscle pump works because of valves and veins as well. All right, so that's a way to think of venous return. Veins hold most of the blood in your body, about 70%, and we can see a distribution of where blood is in veins, small veins and venules, okay, mostly about 70%, large veins a little bit, capillaries hardly any at all, okay, lungs maybe 10%. These veins are what we call capacitance vessels because they hold most of the blood inside your body. Okay, and veins have really thin walls compared to arteries. They can accommodate more blood without much of an increase in pressure. And that's what we call compliance. All right, so veins have very low pressure between 0 and 10 millimeters of mercury. And don't forget, in arteries, it varies between 120 over 80. So hundreds of times or 10 times as much pressure. So what does compliance mean? Compliance means that veins can vasodilate with just a small change in pressure. So they can accommodate a lot of fluid volume. All right, so I have a quiz for you to take. I've got two vessels right here. I have a balloon and I have this Pepsi bottle right here. Which one is more compliant? Okay, I don't know if you see that, but I can generate a certain amount of pressure by exhaling. So I'm going to exhale into this balloon, and will you expect the shape of this balloon to change? Right, it's going to get very big even with low pressure because I can't develop a lot of pressure, right? I would need a like oxygen cylinder. Oh good, it didn't break. All right, so it changed volume a lot with just a small change in pressure. Now I'm going to pressurize this bottle to the same pressure, and is its volume going to change? Not very much at all. I mean, I saw it move just a little bit. You probably couldn't see it, but it moved a little bit when I blew in there. So this is a high compliance vessel. This is a low compliance vessel. Which one is going to be more like a vein? Is it going to be a balloon or this Pepsi bottle? The balloon, right? So that's why a lot of blood is stored in veins as a result. Okay. Oh, sorry. So that's just a little experiment. What we mean by compliance. And since veins are highly compliant, they have a large capacity as a result of that. Oh, yeah, where's that sign-in sheet? It's going around? Good. Okay, blood volume. And thus, blood pressure is controlled by three hormones. And you're probably familiar with these already, but we'll go over them pretty quick. This is what you're going to have to know. You're going to have to know these three hormones. Antidiuretic hormone. You should have a feel for what's going on there. What does a diuretic do? Makes you lose fluid volume, makes you pee. What is an antidiuretic hormone? Makes you, retain water, okay? Then we have aldosterone, and then we have natriuretic hormone. And this comes from, where does this come from? The atrium of the heart. Natriuretic just means, natrium is what kind of element? Natrium is sodium. So this is going to work through a mechanism involving sodium, not potassium, but sodium, right? And aldosterone from the adrenal cortex gland. Okay, so which of these hormones are synergistic and which are antagonistic? Would you expect any of these to be antagonistic to each other? Yes. Absolutely, because that's how you develop precise control and balance inside your body. All right, so let's take a look at these. ADH, antidiuretic hormone, also runs around with another name called vasopressin. Right? Vasopressin and ADH are the same thing. ADH, you now know, is released from the posterior pituitary, right, when osmoreceptors detect high osmolality, high salt in the blood, or interstitial fluid. So how would you combat high salt in your body? Retain, yeah, you could drink, okay, or retain fluid, either one of those, or maybe both of those, right? Maybe these osmoreceptors are being stimulated because excess salt in your diet. Like what? Drinking margaritas, for instance, okay? Or dehydration. The opposite effect would be what? Severe exercise when you lose salt, okay? And these osmoreceptors these osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, right? These osmoreceptors are in the hypothalamus, but ADH is released from the posterior pituitary. That's where it's released from. Right, cause thirst, stimulates water resorption from urine. So this is a function of the kidney. And when we say resorption, oh, but you learned what resorption was in anatomy, right? So you have filtrate inside some kind of kidney tubule, and if you leave that kidney tubule alone, that filtrate is going to end up in urine. Okay, but right, under circumstances when you're low on water, when your osmolality is high, those kidney tubules can actually take water out of the filtrate and put it back in the body. So you're going to produce, as a result, small amounts of salty urine under these circumstances. All right. So, and on the other hand, then ADH is inhibited by low osmolality. So this might be an exam figure right here. All right, I didn't ask you to draw this one out, but it's a pretty good diagram to know. So here you have the stimulus. Right, dehydration or decreased blood volume or increased salt ingestion, that's going to increase osmolality of your body. Oh, here it is right here. So increased blood osmolality, that stimulates osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. Oh, I'm glad that was in there. Okay, so make sure these osmoreceptors are in the hypothalamus, not the pituitary gland. All right, but nonetheless, the hypothalamus does control the pituitary gland, right, via the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. Axons move down into the posterior pituitary. When action potentials reach the axon terminus in the posterior pituitary, they're going to release antidiuretic hormone, which is what we call a neurohormone, because it's released by a neuron, but it's really acting like a hormone. ADH goes everywhere in the body, and in particular to the kidneys, and it causes water retention. It causes reabsorption of water from tubules inside the kidney. All right, so what does that do? That increases blood volume, that decreases blood osmolality, and how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from it? It subtracts from it, so what kind of nice feedback mechanism is that? Nice negative feedback mechanism. And what do negative feedback mechanisms produce in the body? What do they maintain? Homeostasis, right? So when a parameter drifts away from the set point, a negative feedback mechanism makes that parameter then go back to the set point. Okay, these osmoreceptors also in the hypothalamus give you a sensation of thirst, and when you're thirsty, if available, what do? Drink, okay? And again, that increases blood volume, decreases blood osmolality, all right? So that's antidiuretic hormone sensed by, or osmolality sensed by the hypothalamus, but ADH release is from the posterior pituitary. Aldosterone is the second hormone. It's a steroid hormone, and it's secreted from, oh, I told you already. I shouldn't have. It's released from the, because I was on a test. I think you guys were tested on that. It's released from the adrenal cortex. It helps maintain blood volume. Okay, and pressure through reabsorption and retention of salt, right? And when salt is resorbed into your body, that also then draws water back just by a concentration gradient, right? Then water will osmose back into your body. Its release is stimulated by salt deprivation, right? So aldosterone causes retention of salt or reabsorption of salt. So salt deprivation will cause aldosterone to go up, low blood volume, and low blood pressure. All right, so we're going to look at this in a little bit more detail. So if your blood volume is low, aldosterone is secreted, you'll retain salt, but then you'll also retain water. What hormone is that like, in a sense? What is another hormone that we looked at that helps you retain water, that's going to produce small amounts of very salty urine? Antidiuretic hormone. So in that sense, antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone are what? Antagonistic or synergistic with each other? Yeah, they're synergistic. They're not antagonistic to each other. And what do? Do they increase blood pressure or decrease blood pressure? Okay, maybe I can go back to the last slide right here. If you retain water in the kidneys, blood volume goes back up. If blood volume goes up, you have increased venous return. Your end diastolic volume increases. What happens to force of contraction when end diastolic volume increases? The heart gets stronger. Cardiac output goes up. And when the heart becomes a better pump, your blood pressure goes up. So antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone both increase blood pressure as a result. All right, so what's a bigger problem in the United States? Hypertension or hypotension? Hypertension. So we see that now aldosterone and both antidiuretic hormone, all right, ADH, exacerbate hypertension. So I suppose that shouldn't be too much of a surprise. All right, so let's look at this mechanism right here. The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. And this is the most important mechanism operating in people that regulate blood pressure over the long term. Not from second to second when you stand up after sitting and listening to a lecture for an hour and a half, but from day to day, week to week, something like that, because hormones work over a longer period of time compared to nervous system control. All right, so when there is a salt deficit, low blood volume or low blood pressure, right, produce angiotensin II. Angiotensin II causes a number of effects aimed at increasing blood pressure. Angiotensin II causes vasoconstriction. Okay, and vasoconstriction. Think of that balloon. Maybe I blew that balloon up. You grab it and you constrict that balloon. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon? It goes up, right? So vasoconstriction causes pressure that way. But also, I'll show you an equation so that you have a nice impression. As vasoconstriction happens, resistance or total peripheral resistance increases, and that will increase blood pressure as well. Okay, in a little bit we'll write that on the board. Aldosterone secretion, right, and thirst. Both of these work by increasing blood volume, and when blood volume increases, end diastolic volume goes up, force of contraction goes up, cardiac output goes up, and so blood pressure goes up as a result. All right, so here is a really important diagram that you should probably just tape on the inside of your glasses for the rest of your life. Okay, this is the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, and you should really study that because we just all agree that hypertension is an epidemic. It's a serious disease. All right, and what's the result of hypertension? Why is it so an important disease to be aware of? Well, you don't notice it when you have hypertension, okay? But it produces a lot of vascular disease. It will kill your heart. It will kill your kidneys, okay? On and on and on and on. So it's a lethal pathology to have, and so it should be treated. And if you don't have hypertension, but you have somebody with hypertension in your family, then you have to really help them be compliant in controlling that disease process because eventually it will be lethal. Okay, so here is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. The stimulus, okay, is going to be low blood pressure, right, compared to some set point, right, in your brain or low blood flow to the kidneys, right, and the kidneys then senses low blood flow or low blood pressure. And the part of the kidney is the juxtaglomerular apparatus will release renin into the blood. And renin is an enzyme. It's not a hormone, so renin doesn't travel around and bind to a receptor anywhere. But since it's an enzyme, just like for coagulation, it can work on a protein called angiotensinogen. And what can you tell me about angiotensinogen? It's inactive, but it's in your blood ready to go to work at a moment's notice. Renin, when it's released from the kidney under low blood pressure conditions and these other conditions, will convert angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 has some effects in the body. It can cause some release of aldosterone. Oh, what was the take-home message for aldosterone in terms of blood pressure? It boosts blood pressure, right? It increases blood pressure. Angiotensin 1 can vasoconstrict arterioles a little bit. Oh, and we talked about that just briefly. As something vasoconstricts, what happens to blood pressure? Think of just squeezing that balloon, okay? Blood pressure increases again. So angiotensin 1 can increase blood pressure, right? But it's not very effective. There is an enzyme that can convert angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2, and that's called angiotensin converting enzyme. And no one ever calls it that because it's just way too wordy. It's called ACE, right, or ACE, right? Angiotensin converting enzyme. And this is found in the lungs and probably a little bit the liver and kidneys, but mostly in the lungs. So this is strange that you have that in the lungs. So it converts 1 into angiotensin 2. And angiotensin 2, it has a lot of power. It's highly efficacious. It goes to the adrenal cortex, and it causes the release of aldosterone. So it binds to receptors in the adrenal cortex that cause the release of aldosterone. And what does aldosterone do? It causes retention of salt and water. So if you retain water, that increases blood volume, right? And if you retain salt, in particular sodium, right, water that helps you actually draw water out of the filtrate, right? Because water wants to go down its concentration gradient under some of these circumstances right here. All right, angiotensin 2 also is a powerful vasoconstrictor of arterioles. So that increases resistance in these blood vessels, that increases blood pressure. All right, so this is what we call the response, increased blood volume, increased blood pressure. How does that compare to the initial stimulus? Okay. It subtracts from the initial stimulus, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so this is the most important mechanism for maintaining blood pressure homeostasis inside your body. All right, and since this is the most important mechanism, if it misbehaves, guess what that's going to produce? Some abnormality in your blood pressure, right? Including, and especially hypertension. Question? Was there a question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When there's when they give ACE inhibitor medication.
Okay. I'm going to go over that next, but go ahead.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah?
That's what's causing the retention of water, right? So if we prevent AIDS and we just let angiotensin 1 release in the body,
Then that's going to have a tendency to decrease blood pressure.
Right.
Yeah, so that's a nice hypertension agent. Mm-hmm. So I want to go over a number of drugs that act in different ways. All right, so here on this slide right here, right, we're using receptor theory to explain why we use certain pharmaceutical agents to help people with hypertension, right? And we only learned so far two of the hormones that do what? Increase blood pressure, and that's aldosterone and antidiuretic hormone. All right, so what can hypertension be managed by? One of the first lines to help somebody is to give them a diuretic, because what does a diuretic do in terms of blood volume? It decreases blood volume, increases end diastolic volume, right? So the heart gets a little bit weaker, so their blood pressure goes down, right? So that could save somebody's life. But a lot of times, and this is what's really crucial for a family member that has hypertension, usually you can't get by with just one pharmaceutical agent like a diuretic, because you have a set point in the kidneys that says that you should be hypertensive, that your blood pressure should be high. So if you give one kind of drug, guess what your body does? It compensates. So you lose blood volume, okay, but then your body might compensate by vasoconstricting arterioles and your blood pressure goes back up. So the point I want to make is that it might take months or even a year for a physician to adjust a number of different drugs to help somebody control their hypertension, right? And people kind of get disinterested. But you should always tell somebody that hypertension is what kind of disease process? It's lethal. It will kill them, right? So it's well worth their time. The other thing where people have a tendency to be non-compliant is that when somebody has high blood pressure, when they have hypertension, they feel great. They feel normal. And when their blood pressure goes back down to normal, like 120 over 80, guess what? They feel lousy. They feel lethargic. All right, so that's another reason why people have a tendency to be non-compliant. So you got to really help family members out to help get their medication straightened out so that over time they'll feel normal again. But again, it's not going to be just in 1 week or 2 weeks. It might take a year or maybe even longer, right, to where they have kind of a feeling normal once again. All right, so diuretics decrease blood volume. ACE inhibitors prevent the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, and it's the active agent really is angiotensin 2, not angiotensin 1. All right, so ACE inhibitors can fight hypertension as a result. ARBs, these are new kinds of medications. Well, maybe not so new anymore, but they've been maybe around for a while. Angiotensin 2 receptor blockers. All right, so these work on the adrenal cortex where you have angiotensin 2 receptors, or in arterioles where you have angiotensin 2 receptors. So if you block these receptors, that's going to decrease blood volume, that's going to decrease blood pressure, right? So that's another effective agent for combating hypertension. Calcium channel blockers. Okay, where did you run into calcium channels before? Like for regulating heart activity. What kind of receptors in the heart? You have beta 1 receptors, okay? All right, and so then we can block calcium channels, right, as a result of those, the beta 1 receptors. And calcium is important for what? The sliding filament mechanism. So that decreases cardiac function. So if you decrease cardiac function and cardiac output, blood pressure goes down as a result of that. That's not on this slide right here, but these first couple are. All right, and then the alpha-2 agonists that we didn't really talk about when we looked at alpha receptors, alpha adrenergic receptors, these are central receptors in the brain, and clonidine, okay, will stimulate these alpha-2 receptors and then dramatically cause vasodilation of arterioles and dramatically decrease somebody's blood pressure. All right, it's kind of a rough treatment on most people, but if somebody's blood pressure is up over 200 millimeters of mercury and a blood vessel is ready to explode as soon as you turn your back on that patient, then you got to do something, right, to save their life. And clonidine would be a good example of where you would want to use that. Okay, but hopefully you don't have anybody that has to progress to that kind of pharmaceutical agent. All right, so that's ADH, and let's go back to this one. If I can, how do I go back? And no, not end. Not end. Previous. Well, previous. Oh, okay. Went too far. All right. So anyway, this right here, probably you should draw this out. It's not terribly complicated. It seems really complicated when you first look at it and talk about it. But you should probably draw this diagram out probably about 5 times so that you're really familiar with this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Mm-hmm. All right, if you're not a visual learner, then maybe that won't help, but that always helped me to draw stuff out.
Is
okay?
It also an exam figure?
Oh, I'm sure it's an exam figure. Yeah, absolutely. Because why could this be an exam figure? Because this is the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure in your body. And if it misbehaves, you end up with hypertension, which is lethal. Okay, so you can't mess around with this thing.
This only leads to hypertension, nothing else?
Yeah, that's all we know. Yeah. Usually not. It's not involved with hypotension, on the other hand. Okay, so if somebody has hypertension that destroys your cardiovascular system, the lower your blood pressure is, the less cardiovascular disease you have. So if you have really low blood pressure, that's probably a good thing. But you can get to a point, right, with hypotension where it becomes a problem. What would be the point where hypotension becomes a problem? It protects your cardiovascular system, but what's a problem with hypotension? For instance, if you stand up and you don't have enough blood pressure to maintain consciousness, then that's a problem, okay, because then you're going to fall over, your head's going to bounce off the table, then the chair, then the floor, right? It's a mess. Okay, so that would be a problem that you need to address. But usually hypotension is a wonderful thing to have.
Does that also explain, like, when you get up too fast sometimes, you're dizzy?
You're dizzy, sure. Or maybe your blood volume is a little bit too low.
Can that
Maybe you're not hydrated enough. You need to be drinking some water periodically. Okay, yeah. Question. Oh, I did want to make some announcements that I forgot. Okay, so don't forget, when is the test? The test is, you should know, December 1st, a week from Thanksgiving. Okay, so that's on a Thursday, so then both the Tuesday labs and Thursday labs will have two tests. And somebody said that they can't find the study guide for chapter 14, which is in what we're in right now. It's in test number 5. Okay, so look, study guides under test number 5, and it's in there. Chapter 14 is in test number 5, so you're good for that. And that's all I know in terms of the schedule right now. All right, so we talked about ADH, we talked about aldosterone. We got one more to talk about, and that is atrial natriuretic hormone. This involves sodium metabolism. So when you have an expanded blood volume, which means what? Large blood volume. You have a high end diastolic volume, a lot of venous return going back to the heart. So it stretches the ventricle out. There are stretch receptors in the atria, okay, in particular the left atrium. It causes the release of atrial natriuretic hormone. Your book calls it peptide. I don't care what you call it. Just atrial natriuretic something, right? Hormone or peptide. I don't care. That inhibits aldosterone. When you inhibit aldosterone, what happens to blood pressure? So it decreases it, right? It promotes salt and water excretion, right, which is the opposite of aldosterone and ADH, right? So that decreases blood volume, decreases venous return, decreases cardiac output, right, decreases blood pressure. And it also promotes vasodilation. So if you vasodilate, what happens to pressure in some kind of vessel? It goes down. So volume is inversely related to pressure. All right, so that's atrial natriuretic hormone. Here's a nice flow diagram. All right, so increased blood volume, water immersion, I guess that just means too high a positive water balance inside your body, which means then a lot more blood is going to flow back to the heart because blood volume is increased. All right, increased venous return stretches the left atrium. The left atrium then secretes atrial natriuretic hormone, which goes to the kidney that increases salt and water excretion, so you lose blood volume when that happens. Okay, but they're also, the stretch receptors also send signals to the brain via the vagus nerve to the posterior pituitary, which inhibit antidiuretic hormone. All right, so that's going to then cause an increase in urine production, so decreased resorption of water from filtrate back into the urine. All right, that's what resorption is. We've talked about that in anatomy, but if you haven't seen that in a number of years, we're going to talk about that in one of the next chapters coming up. All right, so that increases urine volume, and since that water has to come from someplace, it comes from the blood, that decreases blood volume, and what's the initial stimulus? Initial stimulus was an increase in blood volume, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism that maintains blood pressure homeostasis. Okay, and this is not usually the one that's involved with hypertension. What is a system that's usually involved with hypertension? It is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Okay, all right, factors that affect blood flow. You're kind of familiar with some of these things already. Vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue or an organ. Vasodilation decreases resistance, and if resistance decreases, flow increases. And does it decrease a little bit or a lot when something's vasodilated? A lot. Why is that? Because of the Poiseuille's equation, right? It's the radius to the fourth power. So if you change the radius a little bit, you dramatically change the resistance, right, in a blood vessel and hence the flow through it. Vasoconstriction, right, in the opposite sense, does the same thing, right? So increases resistance and decreases blood flow to a huge degree. All right, so here's just an estimated distribution of cardiac output, all right, and we can see that your digestive system takes a lot, about a quarter. But look at your kidneys. Your kidneys are tiny compared to your digestive tract, And what? It's almost the same amount of cardiac output. So your kidneys are highly metabolic. They need a lot of blood flow to stay alive. Plus, they're processing blood, producing urine. So not only do they need it a lot, they are just doing their job. Okay, so they need a high percentage of blood flow. And skeletal muscles, at least when you're in awake state, get a lot of blood flow through your body. And your brain probably is another organ. So most of your blood is going through your digestive tract, kidneys, brain, all right, and skeletal muscles. All right, so some physics laws, physics that describes blood flow. Think of diffusion. How is something going to diffuse? From high to low, right? And blood flow is pretty much the same way. A fluid, whether it's a liquid or a gas, is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. All right, so here we see the systemic circulation, right? So here's a nice red blood vessel, meaning that it's what, high in oxygen, so that's how I know it's a systemic blood vessel right here. If we measure the pressure in the left ventricle, all right, it's going to have a mean blood pressure of about 100 millimeters of mercury. It's going to vary between, oh, I guess this is the pressure right here in the aorta. It's going to vary between 120 and 80. All right, that's a mean of 100. But in the left ventricle, what are the pressure extremes in the left ventricle? Does anybody have the Wiggers diagram committed to memory yet? What's the pressure inside a ventricle? When it contracts, what do we call contraction? Systole, okay, what's a systolic pressure inside a ventricle? Like 120, all right? And then when the ventricle relaxes after it pumps all the blood out, or at least 60%, what happens to the pressure inside the ventricle? Yeah, it goes to zero. And why doesn't blood flow backwards from the aorta into the left ventricle? It should. But, yeah, because what kind of valve is that? Okay, that is what's called, it's not an atrial ventricular, not a bicuspid, it's the aortic semilunar valve, right? Aortic semilunar valve. All right, so that pressure is trapped inside the aorta, and its mean is 120. The pressure in the right atrium is zero. So the pressure gradient is really easy to calculate. It's just 100 minus zero. So we usually don't write delta P in terms of equations because in the right atrium, it's just basically zero, so we can ignore it. But don't ignore it. The flow rate is directly proportional to the pressure difference between these two places. So certainly you should be able to see that pressure moves from the aorta into the right atrium right here. But what's going to impede flow? Okay, so flow is directly related to the pressure. As the pressure increases, or the pressure gradient increases, the flow is going to increase, but something is going to inhibit that flow. It's going to be inversely related. Flow is going to be inversely related to this parameter. And I'm sure you guys know that. Okay? And it is what? Resistance. So here is a basic flow diagram, or basic flow equation that you got to memorize. All right? So, ooh, what am I erasing right here? Somebody tell me before it goes away. Frank Starling Law. That's right. Frank Starling Law. Okay, just got erased. All right? So we're going to say flow. What's flow again? What is flow? What are the units of flow?
Milliliters.
Yeah, milliliters per minute, for instance, a volume per time. Okay. And what is flow going to be equal to? So if pressure goes up, what happens to flow? It goes up. It's what we call what? Directly related to it. So we could put pressure right here, or you could put delta P if you wanted, but remember, that's kind of nonsensical because one of the pressures is going to be zero, so we don't subtract zero from anything. All right. But, all right, there's another parameter, and that is resistance. So how does resistance affect flow? If we increase resistance, what happens to flow? Say you wanted to leave the room, but I grab your jacket and I put resistance on you. How fast can you leave the room? Not quite so fast, right? So it's inversely related. So where do we put this in terms of this flow diagram? It's going to be in the denominator, right? All right, so that's a basic equation that you just have to know. Plus in lab, you had to know a little bit more sophisticated understanding of resistance. Okay, and that takes us to Poiseuille's law right here. So here we have blood flow is equal to pressure divided by resistance. And in this equation right here, what is resistance equal to? It's equal to the length of a blood vessel. So as a blood vessel or any kind of tube gets longer, the resistance goes up. But how does it go up? It just goes up linearly, right? It's not dramatic. As the blood vessel gets longer, the resistance just goes up, okay? And ADA right here is just the viscosity of blood. As the viscosity of blood increases, what happens to flow? All right, since it's inversely related, as viscosity goes up, maybe your hematocrit goes sky high, maybe it goes from 40-something to 60 or 70, viscosity goes way up, what happens to flow? Since it's inversely related, it goes down. Okay, but now here's that radius term. It's in, right, it's actually in the denominator of the resistance term, so if it's in the denominator of resistance right here, you can put it in the numerator of the blood flow equation. So as the radius increases, what happens to blood flow? Because it's directly related to blood flow, right? If the radius doubles, what happens to blood flow? It goes up by how much? 2 times 2, which is 4, times 2, which is 8, times 2 is 16, right? So if the radius changes by a factor of 2, blood flow changes by a factor of 16. So that has an immensely important, right, effect on blood flow. Small changes in radius cause huge changes in blood flow. And these other terms are in here just to describe the geometry of a tube. It's just supposed to be a circular tube as opposed to a square tube or some other kind of tube. All right, so that's Plazui's law that you should kind of be familiar with. All right, so here is a plot of blood pressure versus that pressure in different kinds of blood vessels. We have the ventricle right here, and you can see, could you have guessed this is the ventricle? Pressure goes from 0 to 120 and then back to 0. Probably by now you would have said, oh, that sounds like ventricular pressure. All right. And then we have blood being pumped into large arteries, like for instance the aorta, pulmonary trunk. Blood pressure there is going to vary between 120 over 80. Now what do these two numbers represent? What's 120? I see it's the peak pressure, but what's a better term? Systolic pressure, and then the minimum right here is diastolic pressure. How come this doesn't go to zero? Yeah, there's blood in these arteries, and when it gets to this point, the heart contracts again, right? And it boosts the blood back up. Okay, small arteries and arterioles. I notice that here's the biggest drop in blood pressure, right? So it goes from a mean of about maybe 90 all the way down to a mean of maybe 35 or so. Here's the biggest drop in blood pressure, which means that this is where blood vessels experience the most resistance to flow in this region. Now here's something important to know. Capillaries. What's special about a capillary? That's where exchange takes place. All right, so So fluids can leave, gases can enter or leave a capillary. But a lot of times when we ask a question, what vessels have the lowest blood pressure, a lot of students are going to just say capillaries because that's the functional part of the cardiovascular system for exchange. But do capillaries have zero blood pressure in them? No. Absolutely not. What has the lowest blood pressure? Large veins. And why is that? Because in order to get blood to flow back to the heart, right, it's got to go from high pressure to low. If capillaries had the lowest pressure, what would happen to blood in these venules right here? Yeah, if there were no valves, right, and veins, then it would flow back into the capillaries. All right, so pressure in capillaries is not zero, and it's not zero because we want blood flowing back to the heart. So what blood vessels have the highest blood pressure? Large arteries. What blood vessels have the lowest blood pressure? Large veins. So blood is going to flow from where? Arteries to veins. Just in that direction, just like that. But here is an important consideration. Let's look at the cross-sectional area. And by that I just mean if we were to take a blood vessel like the aorta and cut it right open and measure, right, the surface area or the area of that circle is what we're going to call the cross-sectional area. That's not a volume. That's just an area, like the area on this piece of paper, except in the aorta would be circular instead of square. All right, so what blood vessel has the highest cross-sectional area? And here is a plot of cross-sectional area versus aorta, arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, veins, vena cava. It is that capillary right here. Because you have so many millions of capillaries, even though one capillary is minuscule in terms of its cross-sectional area, but if we add them all up together, that produces a huge cross-sectional area. All right, and if we put this through a nice algebraic formula and look at flow, all right, so this last graph is flow, centimeters per second, not flow, I'm sorry, velocity of blood. So this is the speed of blood, so just distance per time. It's not volume per time, but just distance per time. What blood vessels is blood flowing the slowest? All right, we see the aorta. Blood flow is fairly fast, about 30 centimeters per second. And in veins, fairly fast, right? Maybe 20 centimeters per second. But what blood vessel is the blood traveling the slowest in? It's capillaries. And that's because it has the highest cross-sectional area that slows blood down. And why is that important? Because if exchange is going to take place, that blood has to stay in a capillary for a sufficient period of time so that exchange can take place. Right? And that's true because you have so many millions of capillaries, right? The cross-sectional area is huge. And so blood flow through a capillary is slow. Yeah?
In comparison to the rest of the flow, what would this be like? How slow, and like, you eventually have to get the blood flowing back to your...
Thousands of times. Thousands of times slower in a capillary compared to an artery. So if blood was flowing through a capillary at the same speed, okay, not thousands of times, 30 times faster, 30 times faster. If blood was flowing at the same speed through a capillary as an aorta, then exchange couldn't take place because the blood just would hardly spend any time in a capillary. But because the cross-sectional area of all the capillaries in your body is so huge, right, now that's thousands of times bigger, the flow is a lot slower, and that allows for exchange. All right, so what blood vessels have the slowest velocity? Capillaries, and why is that? But why is it the slowest? It's because it has the largest cross-sectional area, if you add them all up together, and that's important because blood has to be in a capillary in order for exchange to take place. Okay, dang, convenient place to stop. Blood pressure. Okay, so that's where we're going to start on Tuesday, blood pressure. Ponder this over the weekend. Why is blood pressure related to heart rate, stroke volume, and peripheral resistance? And I'll tell you how to think about that in a very easy way next time.